And it was actually, I learned later on that it was rather serious, because a year later when I sent my passport to San Francisco for renewal, they didn't do it. They didn't renew it. That I wanted to go to Europe. I already had my green card, because I was married to an American woman. But that incident, that they never returned my passport, they never responded to my inquiries, and all that, I learned that it was more serious. But it was basically because of participation in these two social gatherings, really, about 25, 30 people each time, but perhaps also giving Albuquerque a tour of southern Tehran, trying to discredit.
So you didn't return to Iran until when?
No, I returned to after that, until 1970, I didn't return to Iran. By this time, but 3-4 years passed, accidentally I suppose I should apply for the passport again, and this time I wrote to Washington, and they said, well, they write to San Francisco. I wrote to San Francisco. It was largely in connection with getting a birth certificate for my second son, The birth certificate, and in order to do that and all that, they needed all these things. I said, well, I don't have it, so I decided to apply for it, and they gave it to me. They gave it to me, so in the summer of 1979, I went back to Iran. And there was absolutely no incident, no questioning of any kind. After 70, in the summer of 1970, when I had started teaching for them, from then on, I went to Iran virtually every year. Mm-hmm. Without any problem.
You were active here, though.
I was active. But active not, again, in the sense of leading. I was very active in human rights affairs. Whatever I wrote, it was never with my own name. That, even toward the very end, I didn't want to do it. Right, I was thinking, if somebody wanted to report me, I was very well known in giving speeches and writing and things like that. I was active, even though not in association with any particular group. Mm. Not at all.
Individually, you were?
Individually, with... I had learned more and more, but it was, I have to say that my own personal orientation had gradually changed, that I could not really feel completely restricted to Iranian. It was during the anti-war movement. Mm-hmm. I was involved with many American groups. There was this whole movement of international or transnational academic activities that many American students, faculty members and all that, they were in this, so I was involved in the larger sense, and during this period I did my best to solicit support from this larger group for purposes of defending human, always with this very specific focus on Iran, without anti-regime type of rhetoric at all. I mean, I was a member of Amnesty International, and I was very much following the guy. I was extremely taken by the way they approached it. People like, for example, Richard Falk or Ramsey Clark or George Wald. I came to know all of these people during this period, trying to get some publicity through them with respect to human rights situation in Iran, or being perceived as legitimate by other American personalities, and so forth. But I went to Iran regularly, I didn't have any problem.
And you weren't in contact with the students or others active here, like Fatemi or Yazdi or Chamran?
Yes, the Chamran by this time was gone. Fatemi had ceased to be active very early, long before this period. He was, in fact, toward the end, he had changed side, and he had become more interested in accommodation, reconciliation, for example, the last demonstrations against the Shah in Washington. He was opposed to it, and in fact, so he had changed, like many others, not that there was anything particularly different about him. And Shamran was living in, you know, he left his family and children in late 60s and went to 67, 68 and went to Lebanon. He was teaching there. Yazdeep moved to Texas, and he was, again, Yazdeep had also two kinds of, you know, activities. And the reason you retroactively one would assume that Yazdeep's life was completely taken by his political activities, far from it. He was almost a missionary in the sense he was very interested in the American black community in Houston, in the area, propagating a very liberal version of Islam to these people. As a result of that, I understand he even had some enemies from the more militant black Muslims. He used to be very much interested, he's also well-versed and very knowledgeable about Quranic interpretation. So he had a gathering of Iranian students who were interested. And, you know, Texas was a place where a lot of the more religious, you know, Iranians went to school. So his activities were religious, really, in the sense of responding to this thirst for a religious identity, and also political on the side. But I would say, in terms of time and energy, he was largely devoted to religious activities per se, to the extent that outside his academic work. And my contact at this time, when I started beginning in the summer of 1970, when I went to Iran, with people who were active in Iran. Again, not active in the sense of being a part of any kind of guerrilla movement, but people like Sejabadi, you know, Ali Shariati, you know, Karim Lahiji. You know. Again, many of them remnants of the same period who had become, you know, obviously, you know, older and other. Many of these people. So I knew about them, and so we met regularly, and we developed, in fact, a new set of, you know, relationships during this period. And later on, when Lahiji and Bazargan formed the Human Rights Committee in Iran, then I was, every time I had to make a presentation or write something, I had a reference. You know, these people were my source, my representative, in a sense, inside, you know, Iran. But again, there was really no organization. Later on, we knew that all of these things were based on personal contacts and personal trust of very small groups of people. What I found in the period, which influenced me a great deal, was kind of romanticization of the religious activities, including the Mujahideen, by secular, social, democratic, or liberal type like myself. And the reason that we found this area, as we were talking about it, you know, earlier, because a lot of these people in Iran distrusted the Tudeh party completely. Many of them even distrusted the Fedayeen, even though they could not say it publicly, didn't want to say it publicly, but they had gained such prestige, people like in the Gul-e Sorkhi and Jazani and so forth. And yet many of us knew that when we really dig deep, we are going to find the Tudeh party deep down. We knew that. Yet, you know, the Mujahideen, or the religious people, they were more native. So romanticization of these people, even though I was very critical of any form of religious orientation as a general kind of ideology for a movement, beginning, I would say, in late 69, you know, in California, and then 70, my trips to Iran, I began to change and have a much more positive, romantic view of
religion.
Not so much, I would say, religion as such, but the nativity, the nativity of these people. Not so much for rituals or belief system, the fact that they were representative of something very authentic and native. Bumiyetishun was very attractive. Only in the context of any alternative. If, for example, in Iran during the period, there was a progressive secular social movement which was not connected to the Marxist-Leninist and the Tudeh Party and had an independent life of its own, of course people like me would have been delighted to devote whatever time and energy interest we had to this. But in the absence of this, those who were the potential candidates for such a movement, they all gravitated toward the religious side.
Now, when you went back every summer, how did it look to you, what was happening in the country?
The middle class life was obviously becoming more comfortable, more westernized. So as time went on, we felt more comfortable in, and our lives, you know, to the extent that we had, you know, with social life, was all with the kind of people that were in and out of the country all the time. And yet, you know, there was a country out there that was very different from middle class, upper middle class life, you know, in Tehran. And also during this period, whether it's a representative, I think it was kind of representative, that the need for free expression was not simply connected to restoration of Hukumat-e-Qanuni or any kind of egalitarian notion of social transformation, even though all of these justifications were used. I think the need for political expression was autonomous, an end in itself, for a large sector of the Iranian society. That I personally think that even for those who associated and benefited from the regime, who had important positions, they were in a sense alienated as the so-called critical intelligentsia. I saw a kind of suffocating environment, a kind of one-dimensionality, a kind of, in a montage, in orientation, that it's the only way that it could break, you know, out of this vicious circle of self-deprecation. I wouldn't really in those days call it self-destructive, because there was no, in a historical, theoretical sense, we could say eventually, but that's not a political judgment. We really didn't see any political threat to this, but we saw this as a threat to a more interesting, to a qualitatively more challenging life situation. So there was an abundance of ground to criticize and to reject the regime in spite of its achievements in the realm of educational and economic, you know, development. You know, I would say in that regard, later one learns that many people within the regime felt the same way.
Were you tempted at this time to come and work in Iran?
I actually applied. When I finished my work, there was an interview. I had an interview with someone who was recruiting for University of Shiraz. And I was very interested. Mm-hmm. So I was interviewed. He said, you know, I will let you know. And I never heard from him.
So you thought about going back?
Oh, not only that. I mean, when I was in Iran, I went to see Jalili, mm-hmm. who was the editor of this magazine, International Relations. It was published by Danishkade Huquq. Mm-hmm. Do you know Jalili?
I know of him.
I knew that, you know, I had received some copies of the magazine when I was here. This was in 1971, mm-hmm. you know. So I went to the university, I went to see him, to the office of the magazine publication. I found him very pleasant, in fact, interesting. I said, I'm very interested in exchanging position with someone who is teaching here, at least exchanging a one-year position I can teach here, and someone could take, because we had the system in the California system. And he thought about it and got my name and address and quite a bit of information. I never heard from him. And you know, this attempt, I thought if nothing came out of this, because I knew that there were a lot of people in Iran teaching in the university who were really interested in exchanging position with someone who was teaching in a university in California. There was really no shortage. People who had been graduated from Great Britain or the United States. So after that, I didn't make any attend. But both times I was very interested in service, and I was only interested in teaching. I had actually an offer when I graduated from Chase Manhattan Bank, even though I was in international politics and all that. They needed some public relations men for their banking system in the Middle East. And it was a very interesting kind of, they offered me $18,000, you know, in 1969. Was quite a bit of money during the 6-month training, you know, period. And then after that, they raised my salary, and depending on where I go and other, which would have been obviously a lucrative kind of career. But I was totally disinterested in anything else except teaching. I just wanted to remain in a permanent student. So I tried University of Shiraz and University of Tehran. Nothing came of it.
And
toward
the end of that period and the beginning of the acceleration of the revolutionary change, you began noticing the acceleration when? In 77, 78?
I would say in the summer, you know, these are in the flashbacks and all that. I would say in the summer of 1978. Mm-hmm. I personally saw not the demise of the regime, but an inevitable qualitative change in the system, that it cannot, you know, go on, that this massive, you know, politicization. But we didn't know. We didn't know. We had no idea, because the revolutions, by this time I had enough knowledge of studies. I was extremely interested in studying these movements in various parts of the world. I taught courses and so forth. That it wasn't simply the existence of a movement that could bring about revolutionary victory and so forth, but also the ability of the regime to defend itself or to accommodate the. I thought the regime is capable of defending itself, and the regime is capable of accommodating this movement without being structurally transformed. Compromise in the compromise. So the regime definitely has both capacities, suppressing it, accommodating it. There's the two ways that generally these movements are dealt with. What was extremely surprising to me was the total incapacity of the regime to do either. Mm-hmm. That was news. And the reason it was news, first of all, we didn't have information about the capacity of the regime to maintain order or accommodate in opposition. That was one. The second thing is that even for academicians like me, very kind of pragmatic, empirically rooted in their thinking and research and writing, we thought in ideological terms, with respect to Iran, in ideological terms that. The regime is incapable of engaging in compromise for its fundamental ideological opposition to its critics, and there was absolutely no evidence that in Iran that they had ever tried, to do this. So a combination of absence of any information about what is happening inside the regime and the ideological tendency, when I say us, I was a lot less so, but as it grew, I think the weakness of the regime was a total surprise. And I would say that as a student of politics, not only to us, but to American observers as well, as you well know, complete surprise that. That's a different subject. So it wasn't so much saying that the movement is gaining momentum to become successful, but in the process of gaining momentum, you realize that the target you really target is a lot more shallow, incapable of confronting it that you could imagine. So after, I would say, September 1978, in my mind, the situation was over, that it was simply a matter of time before the collapse. Again, another incredible revelation to me that I had seen some bits and pieces of evidence over the years, but I had never made political sense out of them, in the sense that for, let's say, for 10 years I taught in California, in an area that there were lots of Iranian parents of students, all the people who came abroad, friends, relatives, and so on. I personally never met an Iranian, from the general in the army to Vakil, the representative of the Majlis, to high position in bureaucracy, academicians, bazaaris. I never met an Iranian who would say anything which smells of loyalty or sense of attachment to this political order. All critical. Sometimes, you know, they say, well, this particular individual is an exception. Usually the individual is related to them. But the system is. So when the regime was threatened by the movement, people who had benefited so much from the regime, all they could think of was pick up their bags and leave the scene. Which was, you know, completely understandable. I'm not at all using this as any kind of ethical judgment. That's completely beside the point. But then on that level, there is the cross-ideological and cross-class realities. But the fact that they had no trust and no faith in the system as insiders. So one after another. The ultimate one, which was absolutely mind-blowing to me, was Ansari. Mm-hmm. When he went to settle the oil dispute, he ended up in Kuwait. And these were indications that demonstrated to many people, and we were just among the general population in the world interested in seeing the witness. So that was really that. The revolution, what we didn't think in during the period was what would take its place. And I would say really the greatest sin of, if I use it metaphorically and not literally, the greatest failure of the entire Pahlavi period, that we were all, whether people in it or critics of it, were victimized by this situation, was that Iranians, almost against their own rational interest in many ways and situations, had come to believe that the demise and collapse of this monarchy is necessarily and by definition a good thing. Mm-hmm. And when you reach that point, the idea of an alternative loses its urgency, as a political reality. It's well, we get rid of this, we will inevitably make a movement toward greater freedom and other. I think it was only the regime was responsible for that. Only the leaders, Shah at the top of it, and it was responsible for creating this atmosphere. And I never forget someone who was a number of periods, a representative in Majlis from Shiraz, someone who was very successful, he lives in California or London, I think. Once he told me that anybody, he said, yeah, I don't particularly, I'm not religious and I don't know if he wasn't gay, but anybody would be better. Coming from him, a member of a high member of the elite. So we were all in that category. That doesn't justify the failure of a political movement. It only explains why the failure was so pervasive, why it was so all-encompassing among the various political forces and elements. It's
now, in the fall of 78, when it became apparent to you that things are falling apart, You were teaching?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And did you then leave the teaching? And
I was desperate to finish in the, it was in the middle of my term was over in mid-December. Mm-hmm. I had written, you know, an article in a magazine in California, Inquiry magazine, under pseudonym. It was really only an informative in an article that I saw the information was very widely available. I received a call in from the magazine that someone from the Defense Department had read this article and they asked us if we could tell them who the writer is. The Defense Department interested in an article, an article which has had a fascinating kind of history, that I had actually written the article 4 or 5 months earlier, and the Nation magazine, which was a liberal leftist type of, was not interested in the article because I presented a picture that here is a coalition of religious and non-religious movement with the potential to bring about significant change in Iran and other issues. By the time the article was published, I changed it, it became much more radical. It was published in November. Mm-hmm. It was actually written at the end of June, mm-hmm. in 78. So in fact, one of the editors had sent it to Inquiry magazine. Mm-hmm. And then they contacted me to make these changes that it was published. So I said, I don't know if I want to talk to people in the Defense Department. So I immediately called Yazdi in Nofle Chateau and said, listen, I sent him a copy of the article. So this is the Defense Department. He said, well, let me talk to Aha.
And you see, had already gone to Paris.
No, I'm in Sacramento.
No, but you hadn't
gone at all. Oh, no, not at all. Except we can, knowing each other and through activities and all that. So he called me back the next day and said, Aga said it's okay, go and see what they have to say if they want to listen, because he had read the article translated. So I called the magazine back, I said, sure, I will talk to them another, but not now, I want to wait until December 15 when my school is over. I'm going to go to Paris anyway. And on the way to Paris, I would stop in Washington. And I couldn't really leave because it was during the final examinations at the end of the term. So I came to Washington, and it was the most incredible experience. I went to the Defense Department. There was this room and 12 people were sitting there with the yellow pads. And for me, it was another seminar, I had never been in contact with government officials in my life. So I'm speaking of the Iranian situation as if it's a gathering of academicians. But what really was mind-blowing to me was the incapacity of these people to see a movement and evaluate it which doesn't fall into the Cold War framework. Mm-hmm. You see, all revolutionary movements in the world. Mm-hmm. And this article fundamentally said that this doesn't fit into this thing, and I tried to provide background information enough. So we discussed that enough. And at the end, I don't remember, if I see the name, I'm sure I would recognize it, the Undersecretary of Defense in charge of Mid-Eastern Affairs after a 2.5 hour meeting, which was a seminar on Iran. Mm-hmm. Human rights, Mossadegh, and the movement, and Islam, Shariati, and all these things, very generalized. They ask questions, and I'm providing some general kind of... And at the end, the fascinating thing was that this meeting is not official. Once he learned that I'm going to Paris, he said, oh, are you going to visit Ayatollah Khomeini? I said, I hope so. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in all that. He said, well, I want you to know that this is not formal, it has absolutely nothing to do with the Defense Department position. You're here as an expert, mm-hmm. and we're interested in your ideas as a professor and other. So he wanted to disassociate himself with any kind of official contact with, and this is December, mm-hmm. late December, you know, that the situation is pretty much over. Mm-hmm. You know. Still these people were, and from the, right after the meeting he said, now I'm going to a meeting of the National Security Council on Iran. But I want you to know, we have absolutely no message. No. What I learned, you know, in a practical kind of sense was the confusion. Not only in an organizational political sense, but also analytic confusion of the American establishment. And later on, when we read Gary Sick and the rest of them, all confirms that early, you know, experience. That not only they have invited me, but initially they thought I'm just an analyst and just a teacher and all. But later on, when I told them that, you know, that I'm going there and I know these people, and all that, thinking, in Paris, they thought that, you see, the whole idea of that somebody has written an article and the Defense Department finds it somewhat, at least a refreshing way of looking, this guy might have something interesting to tell us, which was their intention. There, for me, contact, I didn't want the contact to be illegitimate. For them, they said, oh, maybe they're asking him to come to the center, they have a message for us, which was no message and all that. All I learned, you know, in that meeting that when I went to Paris, I explained to Khomeini was they were just obsessed with fear of communism. Fundamentally thinking the brightest one and the most intelligent one who had read some of the newspaper analysis of what was going on in Iran, that the apparent ascendancy of religious or nationalist to liberal factions in this movement is temporary, and it is only a matter of time before the extremists will take over. This was the belief, and this belief was rooted in the Cold War framework. It had no evidence, but they assumed that it can the only thing that can happen. And I tried to tell them that this is not necessarily the case, it's not inconceivable, but that has nothing to do with any analysis of the capacities of various, you know, forces and so forth. And when I went to Paris, I talked to Khomeini, which was very interesting. We went to his back room, he had his arachin, you know, on, and he asked me, well, what was their concern?
This is the first time you saw Khomeini?
The absolute first time I saw him. He said, what was their concern, you know, and I explained to him not only what their concern, I tried to put the concern they had in their whole orientation toward the world and Cold War and the division of the world and so forth. And his response, I don't think he really paid that much attention to my effort to provide a context for this attitude. All he said at the end that they have nothing to worry about, you know, communism in Iran, and they don't even have anything to worry about this revolutionary movement developing a more cooperative attitude toward the Soviet Union. At least these people believe in God. اقلن اینا به خدا اعتقاد دارن. اینا, he meant the West. The West, not, you know. By this time he kind of generalized it, but West in general, the United States, you know, in particular, that's all he said. You know, the end of the conversation. But I was, of course, immensely impressed and touched by his simplicity, his lack of arrogance, you know, this, you know, that it's just the nativity, simplicity, lack of arrogance, absence of any claim to power, you know. The seeking at this particular, you know, moment and all.
Was anyone else present?
Yazdi, the three of us. Just the three of us. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the first. And later on, you know, I was there for about 20 days, I met him again and even once interviewed him more formally for another piece I was doing, again for Inquiry magazine.
Mm-hmm.
But when I came back, they did it as a cover story. Yes, but anyway, well, that's a different story, but I genuinely think he believed it,
mm-hmm.
that he wasn't projecting a deceptive image, mm-hmm. in my opinion. The thing that I'm not interested in power,
mm-hmm.
that personalities like Gina Bazargan and so forth were the men he had in mind who would rule the country, who would be the backbone of the executive branch and the decision making. The individuals he was imagining to run the country were the ones who were all dismissed by the end of the first year.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, in it, moving away from time and all that, later on, even in a public statement, he made a reference to this period and said, yes, he was responding to the criticism of Roy Bazargan was chosen as the first prime minister. His response was, we didn't know anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
What he really meant was that there was this massive movement in Iran that he was not aware of, a new social class had come to the fore he was not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
That once he came to Iran, he realized that Iran had dramatically transformed, had been transformed while he was gone, and he changed and transformed, and power played a far more important role in his change than religion or ideological purity.
Personally, when you talk to him, how did he sound? Because there are versions of him as sounding a lot more literate and learned in private than in his public speeches. Did he sound any different when you spoke to him?
No. Depending on the interview I had with him, definitely he sounded. If you spoke to him about his specific kind of interests,
mm-hmm.
you know, his academic kind of interests, of course he was learned.
Mm-hmm.
But when you spoke to him about politics,
mm-hmm.
he was not learned at all. He was an ordinary, common kind of man. It's not that he had he was faking it, and in public he spoke with an intentional way of deceiving others. He was a masterful politician in the sense that he knew his constituents. Even Khomeini proved to be, in one specific, the politician of destruction,
mm-hmm.
the politician of negation, the politician of denial, which is very different from the politician of affirmation and construction.
Mm-hmm.
The two different talents, you know, historically, were Khomeini was the politician of negation and destruction. And in that regard, he was very talented, in the sense that he knew his audience. He knew his audience in the sense that he knew how to choose symbolism which could appeal to his audience. He knew the role of language. He came from a tradition that the language of communication was extremely important. Language, symbolism, metaphor, the simplicity, direct kind of contact with passion, and so forth. Giving you a specific kind of example of what I'm talking about, later in December 79, I'm moving away from it, but now that we are talking about this business of private and public, it's a very telling kind of example that I witnessed. I went to see him, I'll tell you about it later, about this UN Commission of Inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
that I had helped to organize, and I knew that no one else really mattered, and I had made my acceptance of the position at the UN contingent on his approval of the work of the UN Commission. And I said, well, I'll go directly to him. If he says yes, I will do it. And I went to him. Anyway, he said yes and other. But while I was there, something else happened. And what happened was that an artist came in.
Mm-hmm.
There were a dozen people in the room, including Bob Moin Farr, who was, I went with him actually that day. An artist came in and brought four different samples of the new flag.
Mm-hmm.
This was the period that they were working on what you know. A number of people expressed, you know, one person who was, it was Nasir Makarem Shirazi, who is a kind of intellectual mullah, who is also a critic of these people and has never had any position. He was in the room. Mu'in Fahd was there, I was there. So we all thought, there were half a dozen people who expressed the view, we all thought one out of four, which we thought was more aesthetically pleasing, you know. And Khomeini, he put his finger on one, and I don't even remember the specific thing, you know, that, because that's not important. He said, Avam Indra Mipasanda. Khawas, and he did, he, with the gesture of hand, he referred to this, Khawas in Yakirin Khan. In. So, which means that he thought about, and his terms were Khawas and Avam. That the language and metaphors and symbolism of communication differ. And he knew his audience without any question.
Well, the first time that you saw him when Yazdi was there, what was the attitude and the relationship of Yazdi with Khomeini? I mean, how did he treat him?
He was extremely, you see, Khomeini, like Khomeini was in a sense very representative of the way religious people treated religious intellectuals with incredible dignity and deference. They took pride in the fact that Muhandisin Danishgah are religious. I never forget, I mean, it's flashback. As a high school student, we used to go to Masjid Hidayat Friday nights, wait there for Anjuman Islami Muhandisin, consisting of the Bazargan, Sahabi, Mu'in Fahd, Yazdi, all these people come. He had organized. They used to come to the image, I remember, the moment they walk into this, the mullahs and all these people, they all stand up and show glow and incredible respect and not only appreciation but joy. It only came from the way that under Reza Shah and the years later, religion was so degraded and deprecated, particularly by the intelligentsia and intellectuals and so forth. And suddenly the intelligentsia was taking religion seriously. So all these people, I mean, Bazargan was absolutely flabbergasted when many of these people changed. You know, I can, you know, the drawings of these things, the specific examples are really incredible to remember from the pre-revolutionary period. So the image of the mullahs these people had was the image of a great deal of respect and dignified treatment of these people. It exemplified Khomeini's treatment of Yazdi, Bani Sadr, Bazargan, and the rest. He's this university professor, has left his life, and now that he's here at my center. Just later, they completely changed, and it was a different story in the position of power, with much dignity and respect, not only toward Yazdi, including him. He, when I went there, he didn't know me. He put me in the same category, and extremely respectful.
Now, at this point, had you read his writings? Did you know Vilayat Faqih and some of his other...
No, no. His Elam, yes. And the only thing that I had read by him, which I thought was... didn't take it really seriously and didn't feel threatened by it, was Kashf al-Asrar, because it was, you know, and still that is probably far more telling with respect to his orientation than anything else. Well, I shouldn't say I hadn't read the book, but by this time enough of this stuff had been translated into, you know, English, that of course the general lines of argument, there was nothing new in it then, there is nothing new in it today. I think it's the exaggeration of saying that as if ideas determined what happened in Iran, as if we knew the ideas, therefore we could have changed or influenced the course of development. Or the whole business of thinking that ideas determined what they did. No, I don't believe that.
In the sense that you're saying that at that point, Khomeini was not thinking of taking over power
right.
and so forth, it seems as if, you know, he had intended all that.
Not at all. Even in Velayat Faghiya, you know, that later on I studied them with extreme care, there is absolutely no indication. In Velayat Faghiya, when he defines Islamic government and all that, what is he attributing to this government? Very generalized terms, protection of the boundaries, collection of taxes. He says they had absolutely no strategy. Let's say in my specific area of foreign policy interest, I gave a talk the other day, I could say at the time was that there was no such a thing as Islamic foreign policy. There is as much validity in Islamic foreign policy as there is in Islamic physics or Islamic chemistry. You read all this stuff. With the exception of this anti-imperialism or anti-Westernism that you could find in every opposition pamphlet, what is in it?
Absolutely. No, but the Faqih, in the sense that he is the person who determines in the final analysis, he is the one who makes the final decision.
But he's making a completely theological and theoretical kind of argument.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a blueprint, it's not a strategy, it's not a political kind of program. And he makes absolutely no reference to the executive kind of branch of government. Just to substantiate the point, I mean, the best way we could substantiate the fact that he had not thought about any of that was just to look at his behavior during the first year of the revolution. When the first draft of the constitution was submitted to him, and which was written by secular people, and it was a very liberal, very, very liberal constitution, and the references to Islam and all that are very symbolic, just about the same as the references to Islam in the first constitution. Khomeini wrote on the margin of that به رأی عام بگذارید به رفراندوم بگذارید and he was opposed to the establishment of مجلس مؤسسان. At the time they were referred to as مجلس مؤسسان. People who pushed for مجلس مؤسسان were the secular forces. Menlock, Bazargan and the National Front people were far more interested in establishment because they wanted to do it properly and in a legitimate way and other. And if you read that constitution, and when they insisted to Khomeini that by this we need to, in order to gain legitimacy, we need to do that, he said,